Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
I got some sound foam up here. I got some, things are, I don't know, we checked some levels. This whole show is ready to go. I feel like we're wicked on top of this. For the first time.
Hit it, killer.
The show might sound good in 7 years.
It's a shame about the content.
My name is Eric. I'm here with content creator Michael Kester on Double Feature, a podcast on the internet about movies, mostly, sometimes a little bit.
That's the trick, is it looks like it's about movies when you download it. Right. So yeah, we'll call it about movies.
That's the, yeah, there's a twist in it, which is that it's just about whatever happens in the next 49 minutes of our lives.
Yeah.
What do we intend to make this show about today?
Today, our intentions are actually quite pointed because today's show is about our journey this year on Double Feature, which is following the exploits of one Jack Ryan and following the exploits of one Pierce Brosnan or James Bond.
Pierce Brosnan would be so upset if you did that.
Yeah, I know.
God damn it, I'm not James Bond.
I know.
Still,
I know.
Decades later. Has it been decades? When was GoldenEye? When did GoldenEye come out?
A long time ago.
Stop.
We'll call it Before the Matador.
All right. GoldenEye came out in 1995. Thank you, Spotlight.
Yeah.
It was also rated PG-13 and has a 78% on Rotten Tomatoes currently.
So the journey is actually this thing we do where we're trying to figure out the parallels of, I would say, spyhood, but Jack Ryan's not a spy. In fact, I don't know what he is anymore, but he's not a spy. You know, the inner goings on, the interactions of governments with different parts of other nations' governments, spies. It's about
the
fucking
UN
spies.
And spies and reboots and actors who portray different, there are different actors portraying the same characters.
Right.
When you say adventure, we have done a series of these now.
Right.
So you can go back, doublefeature.fm. You can click, there's a link on the side that'll just say something like Jack Ryan plus James Bond or something like that.
Uh-huh.
You can find the other shows if you are relatively new to this show or you have only seen GoldenEye and you're thinking, what the fuck are all these references to previous shows?
Right.
That's what that is.
This is our third Jack Ryan. This is our fourth James Bond, but this is our third Jack Ryan.
How the fuck does that work? Third actor playing. Yeah.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I recorded those shows with you. I think that we did one.
Right.
Film each. This sounds like a really good show. There are a few things that I have to say going into it just to warn people. We're going to spoil both The Sum of All Fears and GoldenEye.
Let's be fair. It's also possible that we'll spoil previous Jack Ryan movies and previous James Bond movies.
So we're going to start with The Sum of All Fears. What if I haven't seen that, but I've seen GoldenEye?
Around the 24-minute mark on your Zune, you can just hop ahead and...
They don't have fast forward on Zune. You just have to...
Well, you just wait 24 minutes. Right. Take your earbud out, wait 24 minutes, put it back
in. Set
a
timer.
And we will either be right at the moment where we're spoiling the most crucial point of The Sum of All Fears or just beginning GoldenEye.
If that sounds like a lot of screwy stuff to remember, what you could do is listen to a more straightforward show. There's this podcast. It's at mattandmattingly.com. You know this. This is Matt Donnelly's podcast. These guys, they actually do two of these a week. He's a big supporter of our show. Their show is on iTunes and Stitcher. It's called Ice Cream Social.
Mm-hmm.
You can find, it's very easy to find because it's all over the place. And once again, just a constant congratulations for continuing your podcast because that's the hardest part.
It's the hardest part of making a podcast. Number one is doing it. Number two is content.
You have an alternative though. If you want to keep your allegiance to Double Feature, but you still don't care about the show, you could listen to DeLovely and The God Who Wasn't There. You go on Apple Music, you type that fucker in. If you're an Apple Music subscriber, you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's a secret. Otherwise, you know, give us $10. That goes straight to us and our distributor. Fuck you guys. And iTunes, I guess. And then, you know, everybody wins is basically what I'm saying. All right, I'm done with all that.
Okay.
The Sum of All Fears. The first thing I want to talk to you about, you made a joke on the last show about how the clear and present danger was neither clear nor present.
Yep.
Now I know we're going to talk about the new Jack Ryan and what the fuck continuity. And
I have a theory on that. I have a very easy theory on that, but continue.
Well, yep. I want to get to all that. The first thing I want to talk about is I did not expect to show my hand a little bit here that we really would be seeing the sum of all fears.
Right.
I think we got that this time.
I think we did. Yeah.
It's not a clear and present danger. It's not a joke. I think I was actually surprised. This is about the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
That could happen in the sum of all fears.
Yeah.
It's not only an atomic weapon. It's a hydrogen bomb.
Right.
And much like we talked about in a recent show, it fucking goes off.
Yep.
Which is just a total game-changing moment in the plot of this.
Right.
Did not expect that at all.
Yeah.
When there's an idea of atomic warfare might start, you always think, well, clearly the path of the movie is that they stop the atomic warfare.
Well, and that's, I mean, that's only natural because that's the path of history.
Yeah, right.
To not necessarily...
Well, with the exception of twice.
Right. I don't want to spoil any other movies that are outside of this franchise, but there are other films where they go, well, we know this doesn't happen. And then that gets shot in the face toward the end of the movie. And you go, huh?
Yeah,
that did happen. This movie doesn't take place in this universe, does it? And the sum of all fears is it's funny to come at it from the Jack Ryan perspective, because we're so firmly, for me, I'm so firmly ingrained in this reality that Jack Ryan is based in my universe.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tom Clancy is very aware that it's not in our universe.
Yeah.
Because he can do whatever he wants because he's the writer. So when the bomb goes off, it's not only a betrayal of your expectation of the trope that they're using with a movie that teases the bomb.
Yeah.
It also betrays your greater knowledge of planet Earth, which is that that happened once and we try to pretend it didn't happen. We do because we're terrible. Everybody else goes, hey, you did it though.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys did it.
Sure. Sure.
We go, well, we did it and we learned from it and you all learned from it too.
Yeah. I don't want to go off too much on the atomic theme, but I do think it's funny how in US movies, we talk about this a little bit with Asian movies, specifically Japanese movies, where the atom bomb is always present.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in their genre films, how it's created decades worth of genre films. And in a lot of ways, their view of the atomic bomb has not changed. It's still something to be fearful of. It's still something that even when you're not actively afraid of it, it always looms in the background.
Yeah.
And with American films, even more frequently, I mean, I think almost always we're dealing with what if the atomic bomb happened to us.
Right.
You can read into that however you want, if it's our kind of like atomic guilt or whatever.
Atomic guilt.
You know what I mean? I just came up with that idea like that.
Trademark.
Yeah.
Trademark that as quick
double
as possible.
Double feature, atomic guilt. That sounds like an additional content waiting to happen. Once again, I'd like to shame Ben Ecker. Don't you stop writing things down. I know he's back there going, oh yeah, atomic guilt. Cross-referencing atomic guilt and Kurt Russell somewhere. Yeah, but I mean, you know, I do think it's interesting. We're always going, what if these attacks happen to America? We do that because the attacks almost never happen to America.
Right.
And that's shifted a little bit since 9/11, but
sure,
it hasn't changed the fact we're going, well, you know, here's 2002, a year after 9/11, and we have this movie where a bomb goes off. Wondering how controversial that was at the time, you know, it was probably
they had Morgan Freeman. It's probably safe.
Yeah. All right. Well, so Morgan Freeman
is our national Band-Aid.
Isn't James Earl Jones. He's not Samuel Jackson. And I'm pretty sure he's not Alec Baldwin.
Right.
So I'm wondering, who are these characters? What universe are we in? Give me your grand theory here.
Liev Schreiber plays Willem Dafoe's character. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that.
So they're the same person. And so that is actually the fundamental key that leads me.
I was looking for, yeah.
Yeah, that leads me to arc this in a certain way. So in Clear and Present Danger, Willem Dafoe plays kind of this ex-agent who's way out in the cold, just doing his own thing in South America.
Mm-hmm.
In this, he's definitely not an ex-agent. He's a very suited, he's the Trevelyan, the 006 of this film.
Sure.
And,
it's only a spoiler if you think about it too much. So just stop thinking about it.
And for me, I think this movie could arguably take place immediately before The Hunt for Red October.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jack Ryan goes from what I'm assuming is a shadow recruit to a historian because something goes wrong, and then becomes an analyst.
And interesting.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that would solve the arc of why the Willem Dafoe character goes from an agent to an ex-agent in three films.
Yeah, right.
Instead of the other way around. So the reality is, and this is the sad thing, is that the general accepted thing is that this is a reboot.
Yeah.
But while we're pairing this with James Bond, I can't accept that a reboot is just a reboot.
Sure. Well, we're also going to get into some tricky territory when we revisit our fan theory James Bond idea.
So
new evidence coming soon on Double Feature.
So I feel like I can't accept that this is just an alternate universe.
Alternate from our own universe, but not from the previous Jack Ryan universe. Right.
So I think that this movie could be a prequel to The Hunt for Red October.
The first thing that got me, I mean, we could pretend that it's a continuation of Harrison Ford's character in the previous one.
Right.
Obviously, Ben Affleck is younger, but we just go with it.
And he forgot everything. And he doesn't have any kids.
Yeah.
And
well, that's when it starts getting tricky, is when he's with this new woman.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh man, we really missed something.
And he's a historian.
Yeah. So now we know we're dealing with her earlier. It is the woman who ends up being his wife.
Mm-hmm.
The same doctor character from the previous movies. The people he's surrounded with are different, but obviously, when you know, I make the joke about Morgan Freeman playing these other characters, it is no mistake that the previous Jack Ryan characters revolved around the central Jack Ryan analyst and the black authority figure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at the covers from these movies and they're pretty much like, well, let's replace James Earl Jones with Morgan Freeman.
Right.
Although they are not the same character.
Right. They're not.
And it could be misleading because of the way it's cast. The movie is so making you think we got another one of them, Jack Ryan and black guy who knows all the stuff about the CIA movies.
Right.
But then his character dies. So not knowing enough about the Tom Clancy universe, I'm wondering where that guy plays a role, and if it is a stand-in for a previous character, kind of a recasting of that or what have you. And so under the theory you're operating in, this would be how he made his way into his job, I guess, as an analyst.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little thrown off when you said you don't know what the fuck he's doing, because I think we get some heavy analyst stuff.
Yeah, we do, but he's a historian. That's what I'm saying, is that he may be an analyst in action, but in title he's, you know, part of a think tank.
Yeah. Well, I love them all sitting around and doing their day job of,
yeah,
you know, watching this tape and speculating on this guy's weight and what that means, and even, you know, really just making a joke out of it and then coming back to it at the end. We also have a very scruffy looking Jack Ryan again. You know, down to the colic and the hair, the sort of messy haircut, very scrappy. You know, he doesn't have a suit to go to this meeting and all of that. I'm actually thrown off by the fact we have the president around, because we're in a
just hanging around
fucking flak jacket. And I'm thinking,
yeah,
oh yeah, you do need a suit jacket.
Mm-hmm.
I start that scene and go, well, if his skills are so desirable, then who cares if he's wearing a goddamn suit? And then I see who's in those meetings and go, oh yeah, that was, you're sort of inappropriately dressed there. So yeah, you really get that sense of, even prior to the Alec Baldwin version, that this guy doesn't know anything about being a part of the government.
Right.
You know, that he's not prepared for meetings. Jack Ryan wasn't prepared to go on a submarine the first time we saw him.
Yeah.
This Jack Ryan is not prepared to go to meetings.
And I have a feeling that, come the final installment of the Jack Ryan series, we're probably going to have to reach a little more to tie it into the same universe.
Nah, it'll be fine.
Because I feel like the sum of all fears, like you're saying, is definitely a very rubish Jack Ryan.
Rubish, sure.
An unseasoned professional.
Mm.
And I have a hard time believing we're going to get an entire picture of Rubish Jack Ryan in a film called Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit. But who knows?
Well, I'm a little bummed to see that this continuity doesn't move on, because I mean, Liev Schreiber is great. Morgan Freeman is great. Ben Affleck, I think, plays a great Jack Ryan.
He's definitely,
Ben Affleck's career over time morphed so much, and he's proven to be really versatile, actually, when you think of him in, I mean, look at the contrast between this and fucking Batman, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to pretend the bat is not in the room when we do these shows.
I know.
But he's literally playing Batman. I mean, he's playing a superhero, this huge fucking guy, and then he's playing a scrappy analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, and then, you know, you throw his mix of directing in there. So I'm not sure that I would, if we're going to play Rhett history here with Ben Affleck's career, I don't want to take him out of anything he did to keep him playing Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
But just this whole cast coming together the way they do.
Yeah.
The president of the United States,
sure.
Total, by the way, 10 year ago president.
Oh yeah. Perfect.
This is what you think of as a president in the Bush
in
era, not in anything post.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll ever have a president that looks like this guy again. He was such a movie.
Clearly not anytime soon.
Well,
that's what
I mean, just look at the representation in film.
Yeah.
Once we got post 9/11, we really started to hit basically any president who doesn't look like our entire history of movie presidents.
Right, right.
And that thing people say during elections of, oh, does this person look presidential? I mean, you know, fuck what that means during elections, but in movies that really is.
Sure.
You cast for a very specific, oh yeah, I could see that guy being a president.
Yeah.
Movies were more progressive about what a president looked like before actual society was.
Yeah.
But movies also were deeply entrenched in this guy has to look like Nixon or kind of like Reagan like whatever.
Right.
And then we hit a point where I think our president here actually probably has to look like George Bush Sr. I think that's a little of what we're going for.
Yeah.
But even if we're not, it's just the total president archetype.
And that's interesting too, because you compare that to Kieran Hines playing Russian president.
Yeah.
Compared to the now known image of the current Russian president. And I think in 2002, Kieran Hines is like, yeah, that guy's definitely ruling Russia.
Yeah.
you know, it's the same thing. Although his role is probably... In a movie like The Sum of All Fears, they could easily get away with writing off the Russian president as, I don't know, just put some canned Russian president dialogue in there.
Yeah.
But they actually give him kind of a complex role that drives a lot of what goes on in the foreign portions of the movie.
Oh, yeah. Between him and James Cromwell, I think there's a great push and pull there. The whole movie rests, to me, not in the action sequences that we started chucking our Jack Ryan into, but really his job for a majority of this movie is to convince them that it's not the Russians.
Yeah.
And once again, we're always looking at, are these analytical at heart? Do they stay there? That's become the entire fucking theme of this adventure on the Jack Ryan side.
Mm-hmm.
How much better a central conflict than I have the information, I have to convince everybody else tactically that it's, you know, to prevent these two sides from going against each other.
Right.
And so, yeah, a lot of that's going to come down to James Cromwell's performance and even Ron Rifkin. I mean, the whole cast of this, it's just like a perfect, all of these guys went on to play political figures in some respect in other parts of their career, maybe except Ben Affleck, although I'm sure I'm forgetting like some obvious role in some 90s movie, some 90s Bullworth type movie where he's a rapping senator or something. I don't know.
An unlikely accidental president. He does a swap.
A Wag the Affleck type movie.
A president and the pauper type movie.
Yeah, sure. So I've often wondered about, we have this idea of mutually assured destruction. I'm going to give this to you, even though we have basically no time to talk about it. But I rest in a spot where mutually assured destruction is so important. And it's the reason that the Earth has not been blown in two, especially when you see, as we've been talking more and more about these atomic movies, I've been studying what our current state of atomic weaponry is. By the way, it's fucking terrifying. So don't do that. I'm just letting you know right now, I try, just don't. You will dig a hole and crawl in it. And you'll be one of those bunker people.
Get blown up anyway.
you'll become one of those people who stockpiles food. The thing about mutually assured destruction that's terrifying to me, though, is what if you have So in mutually assured destruction, we don't blow up Russia because Russia will blow up us. And Russia doesn't blow us up because we will blow up Russia. And we have these massive weapons now that as soon as one is fired, the other fires, we just blow the whole place up.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a third party pitting those two parties against each other, I think the promise of mutually assured destruction that keeps us at peace might go away.
Yeah.
And since, you know, the Cold War lived in the fear of mutually assured destruction before people realized it's kind of the assurance that we won't blow each other up, I hadn't stopped in all my life to consider, what if a third party manipulates the two parties to kill each other?
Yeah.
Does that terrify you? Like, it terrifies me.
I just,
if there's a sort of setup like this, right?
Yeah. Right. I think for me, again, this is just me writing it off, I think, but I'm so far of the mind that there are so many allegiances and underlying handshaking. I'm not saying anything shady or conspiratorial.
Sure.
But I feel like in a mutually assured destruction scenario where it's triggered, while the US and Russia are both going, well, you know what? Let's just do it. I feel like there are other parties now. I feel like it's not a bipartisan system. I feel like if the bomb gets fired from Russia, the US isn't the only thing that's firing back. And if the US fires, I mean, we're approaching a point in the world where Korea can shoot rockets.
Yeah.
Where sure. There are African nations claiming to have the bomb. We are not far from the point in time where it doesn't matter who fires the first shot, because everybody can retaliate.
That's true. Although you get into this area, I mean, this is a nuclear football movie. That's why I bring that up.
Yeah.
This is probably the first time since we did The Last Boy Scout on our Bruce Willis Palooza additional content show,
uh-huh,
where we're really spending time going, here's the suitcase, put in the codes, this person turns this key, and, you know, verbal agreements and all of that. It seems like when we do Cold War-ish movies, the idea is antiquated. It's really interesting for me to look at our fears here starting to be brought into the 21st century of, okay, well, maybe we don't worry about a third party that would be bombed by the rest of the world. But in modern times, we worry about the Islamic State,
right,
or whatever terrorist group who, you know, a death cult. Right? Yeah. Who doesn't care about mutually assured destruction.
Exactly.
That's part of their plan anyways.
For me, the concern is becoming that we can no longer fire within borders,
right,
to attack the enemy. And I wouldn't necessarily, and I'm not saying I'm not a war person at all, even a little, but my fear is not that you can't just bomb Afghanistan.
Sure, sure.
And solve the problem, because the problem doesn't live within the borders of Afghanistan. My fear is that other people feel that way, that other people are going, just bomb Afghanistan, that'll take care of ISIS. People are, for some reason, in 2016, they're unable to understand the fact that sovereign nations don't actually have it. War is not the same as it was.
My foreign policy and my policy on war has always been John Lennon's Imagine. That's just my guide to peace on earth.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I was kind of shaken thinking about these things. I mean, it's just like gun violence in America. I'm sort of in a state of, I don't really know.
Yeah.
Imagine there's no countries used to be a guiding principle. What if we just didn't,
same.
You know, the earth would be fine. And
right.
Now imagine there's no countries has made warfare very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm just back to imagine there's no heaven.
Yeah. I think that's the starting point for me. That is the one part of some political campaign that if that were somebody's number one platform was imagine no religion, I'd be like that guy.
Well, let's move back to an easier, earlier time when GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Is this the most popular Bond movie? What do you think? For our generation, maybe, right?
Definitely. I think...
I feel like the Bond movies somehow get more popular as time goes on. But
I think that there are definitely certain Bond movies. Dr. No is the first one, so that one's always going to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
Octopussy has the word pussy in the title.
And thusly should be the most popular.
Right. Thunderball, that's easy to remember. And then there's GoldenEye, which GoldenEye, I think, has endured fame because it was the first modernization of James Bond in our generation. And also, and it's obvious, but man, the game.
Yeah.
The game so solidified the GoldenEye thing in not even just youth culture. Anybody who played video games at the time played GoldenEye, regardless of whether or not they had seen the movie. And I know this because I played the fuck out of the Nintendo 64 GoldenEye and didn't see the movie until
years later in your life, right? Yeah, yeah.
4 years ago, I saw it for the first time.
Yeah, well, we might as well get the video game thing out of the way right away because it's impossible to avoid. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to avoid. So for people who don't play video games, you have to understand at the points, you know, we were pretty young when GoldenEye comes out. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I really thought about seeing a James Bond movie in the theater. That was...
Yeah, definitely. You know, definitely.
It had not even been on my radar before that.
Yeah.
James Bond was your dad's thing. It was not your generation's thing.
Yeah.
And for a lot of my friends... I mean, I mentioned before on the show previously, I didn't see a lot of movies growing up.
Yeah.
But everybody had played this goddamn game.
Sure.
It was the best game of that generation. And don't feel too detached if you don't play video games, because all it is scene for scene, the fucking movie.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. I know the layouts of the rooms that are not even shown in this movie.
The only difference is, and this is the interesting part, and I think the thing that I really want to talk about when I'm contrasting the game and the movie, there are parts of the movie that you have to play for 30 minutes in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I think of most specifically that opening scene with the bungee jump.
Oh, yeah.
That's the first map in the game. That's a whole level of James Bond.
Yeah.
Getting through that damn facility and turning off the alarms and, you know, doing all the stuff, taking pictures of some bullshit for some reason. That's all that would take in the game. That would take you 20 to 30 minutes to do all the way through. Whereas in the movie, it starts and ends. James Bond basically just goes, I got to jump off this, and jumps.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there watching the movie going, why did I have to go through so much shit?
If you start the movie and start the game at the same time, the movie finishes and you're still fucking around in the facility.
Exactly.
Well, you spend a lot more time in those environments in the game, and you can revisit them over and over and over. And it's a very interesting thing to have parity between the two, because you rarely get an opportunity to... I talked about this a lot when we did Alien Isolation. It's been on my mind a lot recently.
Right.
But
right.
You take an experience that was only an hour and a half, 2 hours, and you stretch it out into 20 hours. Mm-hmm. And in the case of GoldenEye, because of, you know, just multiplayer, you're running around for an infinite amount of time in these levels, which are sets from the film. You really get it helps you build and imagine a whole world in your head that's only briefly seized upon.
Well, I mean,
in the movie,
it's important to note too that, like, the game, I know the characters' faces from the game.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Right.
Like, it's not that I know them as actors. It's I go, oh yeah, I know that's Valentin. I know him. He's in the statue level. He's in that storage container.
Right. Well, the unsung hero of GoldenEye that people don't mention nearly enough is Alan Cumming.
Oh, yeah.
Who I can't even believe. First of all, there's a game where you can play as Alan Cumming. So, you know, mm-hmm. that should be enough. Mm-hmm. But he is, I don't want to say he's unrecognizable in this. It's just a... You know, Alan Cummings plays all of these larger-than-life roles. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily goofy, but they're very much about his... I don't think of him as a physical performer, but man, I go mm-hmm. back to these roles.
Yeah,
and there's totally. Something about the way he moves and the life he breathes into these characters that could be very... I mean, with any other actor, they'd be so different. And he really... His performance creates... what on paper would be something else entirely. Mm-hmm. And that's very true in GoldenEye, as much, if not more, than some of his other roles we've seen in the show. It's very distinct. It's a very amazing thing. The actor that I think is strangest in this to consider as a role for something that is so,
All right. I'm curious.
Iconic is Sean Bean.
Yeah.
Well, we could talk about On a Top in here too, but then
that's what I was going to think.
I feel like we're going to go into a big, long X-Men conversation then. We just can't. Although I think she's fantastic in this.
Sure.
But Sean Bean's an interesting role in here because I won't get into the thing
we've die two times. Is that what you're
talking
about?
Talked about before, right? Which is Sean Bean dying. We've covered that on previous shows.
Oh yeah.
I don't know where, but just look through his filmography and match him up yourself. I'm sure we've had that conversation more than I want to acknowledge. But he dies in the beginning of this movie. He's too big an actor to die in the beginning of this movie. Are people fooled by this? I know, haha, he dies. But you have to know when his name is the second one in the credits.
Hold up.
Uh-huh.
You think Sean Bean's career in 1995 was they wouldn't kill him in the beginning of the movie?
Yeah, totally. I do.
Really?
I definitely
Why?
Do.
Because of Equilibrium?
No, I just think because he's second billed.
No.
Because he is...
He's second to show up. I think that
people bought for an hour that he was dead?
Absolutely. I don't think anybody...
It just makes such a big deal out of them being together.
In 1995, I didn't even know who Pierce Brosnan was. You're telling me that people... I don't think outside of maybe a split face recognition, people knew almost any of the actors in this movie.
People really love Black Beauty. That's all I'm saying.
Joe Don Baker, people may have known.
Uh-huh.
And also somebody with a keen eye may have recognized Mishkin from The Patriot. That's about what I got for you.
Okay. All right. People would have recognized Judi Dench. Especially if they follow our show.
Right, totally.
So the Judi Dench is where we start to hit an interesting point in what was previously dismissed on our show as some fleeting fan theory about James Bond's all being the same, replaceable, whatever, same universe thing.
Yeah.
This is where, so her character comes in and she is... In the fiction of James Bond, she is a replacement for the previous M.
Right.
So they do treat her as if there was that M who was around this whole time. They talk about her predecessor. And also, they give her ample room to really put her stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
To really go, you know, I don't drink the same drinks. I don't play the same boys game. I mean, this is the movie that is so frequently mentioned in the conversation about the role of women in James Bond movies, where she says you're a sexist dinosaur, you're a relic of the Cold War. And where we were getting that sarcastic challenge last time we saw James Bond of, you know, the really funny moment of, come on, guys, I'm not a total.
Mm-hmm.
You think I'm a womanizer, but I'm not that James Bond. We really have a character. I mean, we don't have to wink and nudge each other at maybe this film's accidentally not sexist.
Right.
This is clearly a moment where they're going, female M does not like the boys club,
right.
Relic of the Cold War. And they're pushing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's relevant for the conversation about women in Bond, but I think more interesting for us is, does this put these in the same universe?
There's two interesting thoughts about that. One is obviously. So here's where I think we need to make some assertions. One, all the films are in the same universe. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that we are really questioning is whether we are to accept that the James Bond in GoldenEye is the same James Bond that
right.
The man, not the title James Bond, but the man in GoldenEye is the same man who killed Dr. No.
Yes, I would agree with you. Yeah, of course, they're in the same universe. That's the great part of the
right.
The author's fiction that we're doing in both of these series.
Right.
But yeah, is it the same guy? Does he have the right. memory of...
Exactly.
Like Terminator, right?
Right.
Is it the same robot?
Or does, just like M... Do they just replace them with a new person with the same name, same title? Now, here's the thing. We get two clues on that. One, we get a 006 in this. 006 dies. They don't replace 006, and James Bond doesn't change from 07 to anything else.
No, he doesn't. No. So your, your theory of, of the continuing number, it at least doesn't go the six direction. Right.
So that is definitely out. But M also makes a point of saying she doesn't drink the same drink. Now, this is an obvious one because James Bond always drinks the same drink.
You've nailed it. That's the smoking gun, the linchpin, proverbial thing in the theory that does the wrinkle with the whatnot.
Right.
Okay. I mean,
but that could be, so hold on now, maybe, in the James Bond training manual, they go, listen, you're assuming this character. You're this guy. You aren't yourself anymore. You are 007 James Bond. When the legend gets heard in Severnaya,
sure,
that James Bond is a womanizer who drinks his martini shaken, not stirred, and you show up respectful to women and you order yourself a nice cold vodka tonic, something's going to be amiss.
Yeah, well, he is James a spy Bond after all.
Womanizes. Exactly.
Uh-huh. I love this.
Yeah.
So I'd like to once again, here is a become a tradition on Double Feature to create better James Bonds than currently exist. I want to see the reluctant womanizing James Bond.
Yeah.
The guy who is the super progressive agent who lives in the modern era.
I think we almost saw it with Timothy Dalton. That's how I felt about Timothy Dalton.
See, I feel that way about Daniel Craig and his relationship to the Bond franchise, as he is the reluctant James Bond.
Yeah.
But I want the Bond who clearly is not a womanizer, but has to go undercover.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes back to the agency and he's grief stricken.
Yeah.
He's super bummed about what a fuck he has to be. And then he goes back out in the field and has to just schmooze and be despicable. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the great places that that theory comes from, because they replace M, but call Judi Dench M. It's so clearly a new M. Obviously, there's the drink thing, but also the gender thing, which I guess seems just as obvious. By keeping the same lettered character, and then also the, you know, looking at Q's character, we're going, all right, same timeline, same continuity.
Right.
Later, when we bring in new Bonds and we see M once again reprising the role, this is a very interesting fictional concept to think about. I think the truth of it is they're trying not to think about it too much.
Right.
They're just, you know, in this movie, it's what opened that can of worms, I think, that maybe they didn't consider, you know, how far reaching the implication of the fiction might be there. Q has, in this movie, probably the best gadget scene we've had yet on the show.
Yeah.
They realize that this is a thing.
Yeah.
And they're fucking going for
it. This is a very, to me, this is like Joe Dante and Stuart Gordon's little like studio, and they're like, oh yeah, sure, you want to shoot James Bond in here, that's fine.
Yeah, right.
And they're like just be careful, because we've got this exploding telephone booth from the Looney Tunes back in action, and this over here, you know, Stuart was using this for Honey I Blew Up the Kids, so you know, don't touch that one.
Well, they just go, I mean, it's what, every 5 seconds there's a new gag.
Yeah.
There's things going off in the background. There's a continuing joke of the guy with the booth in the background.
Uh-huh.
And they even end on a joke predicated upon the frequency of other gags.
Yep.
Which is that every fucking line has been in a gag. So by the time they reach the sandwich, you assume it's a gag. And in doing so, it's funny that it's a sandwich.
Right. Right.
Thanks, Q.
Well, and also it allows for one of the most confusing numerical scenes in the history of cinema, which is when Boris is nervously clicking the pen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're sitting there going, I've lost count. I'm going to wait until James Bond is nervous. That's right. All I can do at this point.
Yeah. The pen scene is one of the iconic moments. I think it's so hard because of where we grew up in the franchise. this seems like the most iconic Bond to me. I'm not sure that's really true.
Uh-huh.
But every scene I can kind of point to and go, this is the USSR. This is what a USSR facility looks like. This is mm-hmm. the fucking pen thing. The pen was not part of the game, but is still incredibly iconic to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The long fall off the satellite where a person doesn't splat. Yeah. I think probably the longest fall in movie history that doesn't end with a splat.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they cut to him at the end.
Yeah. Well, that whole thing is weird too, because if you want to talk about the game, I feel like that was the moment where the game saw how the movie did it and was like, I have an idea, and did something completely different.
Yeah. 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 Some of those things age better than others. I think Straight Up with a Twist sounds like a Limp Bizkit line today.
Sure. Yeah.
Also, maybe you two would like to finish debriefing each other at Guantanamo. Has a totally different meaning now.
Yeah.
It was cute then.
Yeah.
And now that is...
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
Yeah.
You'd never say that in a movie. That's the worst. That's some Gaspar Noé stuff right there. You would not dare.
Speaking of you two, we get Paul Hewson and... The Edge composing the title song.
Oh my God. The opening credits.
I know.
Are getting more and more ridiculous.
I know.
Hammers this falling one, through the sickles.
And this is
floating naked silhouettes against falling statues. It's a parody of itself.
The thing that we're approaching in our adventure is, so we're blindly doing Jack Ryan. We, as far as I know, unless you've been lying to me, neither of us have seen these movies. We don't know what's around the corner for Jack Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
For James Bond, I feel like we are approaching our most familiar place.
Right.
I feel like it's probable that I know you've seen all of them,
mm-hmm.
but I still feel like as it becomes more current.
Oh, that's not true anymore, by the way. Because oh, of really? Spectre, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
So now we're...
So I feel like as we're approaching more current James Bonds, we are more... just because we're contemporaneous with the movies,
mm-hmm.
we're more aware, we have a better gauge of them. We're less speculative on what are they saying and what was going on at the time and why are they always afraid of the fucking Russians?
Well, they didn't have all those models around to start pounding on their statues with sledgehammers. That's why they're
right. So that is, to me, been the part of these movies that I think is the most emblematic of it getting modernized is the theme songs. And we'll definitely get into that when we move into the final phase, the current phase of James Bond, because, we're moving back into every James Bond theme gets an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, sure.
The Pierce Brosnan James Bond movies are kind of that weird phase where your favorite band changed their genre for one record.
Yeah.
And so all the Bond themes are like, this is what Aretha Franklin with U2 composing. And then it's like Garbage does the next one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all these, it's, they're trying to be contemporary without being classy about it. And then eventually they move into Skyfall, but
it's so weird to me that you have to remember looking back at this, that people thought this was the modernization of James Bond.
Right.
Modernization, excuse me. They thought this was the, finally we're going to get out of those old movies and do something fresh. And
right.
And now you look back on it and, you know, Onatopp is the first character in double feature history to be wearing my pants.
Yeah.
So clearly a 90s relic.
Uh-huh.
I mean a 20-0 fucking whatever GoldenEye.
Yeah.
I just looked this up. What was it? 2002?
No, GoldenEye's 95.
Oh, 95. Yeah, it is a 90s relic. It's a total mm-hmm. 90s relic.
Mm-hmm.
And that we, you know, next time when we look at James Bond, we're going to do what we think. We're going to use the term modern a lot, I'm sure. Well, we're going to say it's today's Bond.
It's interesting because I'm nervous about that. So
that's what I'm saying is in the same way that people look at GoldenEye in 95 as modern, we may start looking at the Daniel Craig Bonds and go, that's a little 10 years ago.
Well, but here's the thing is, this is a good point to mention this too, since we're coming to a close on this one. But so for the Daniel Craig James Bond, you and I had actually a disparity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you and I, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but you and I both feel like Casino Royale is probably the best of the Daniel Craig Bonds, right?
It's got the most time at the poker table. It has to be.
Sure. It's got Mads Mikkelsen. I mean, it's the one. So that's...
Your answer is better than mine on that, by the way.
So that's why we're doing it. But I wanted to, when I was choosing these movies, I wanted to do Skyfall as the definitive Daniel Craig conversation
mm-hmm.
for the James Bond. And eventually all you had to do is go, hey, I want to do Casino Royale. And I'm like, great, me too. that was the debate on that.
Yeah.
But I will say, last time you won the debate, we did Moonraker.
That, so this is going to be one of two things. It's going to be my vindication on Double Feature or my last episode of Double Feature.
Right. So I'm afraid that since Casino Royale was the first Daniel Craig movie, it's going to be a little ham-handed. I think it's going to
find out next time.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. I can't say more because I don't know yet, but
you could say that the website is doublefeatures.fm. Mm-hmm. The email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com and that there's a list of producers that you are prepared to give us right now.
Yeah. That's Brianna Kruger, Mike Shaw, Seth Fielder.
No. You got the
Juan
first one.
Hanasek.
No. Juan Hanasek. The producers, of course, are Brianna Kruger, Rod Fielder, Seth Hanasek, Enrique David Koch, and Leah Napolitano. And they've got another fine episode coming up for us next time.
Apparently, it's Daisies and Bad Education, which is a Pedro Almodovar film. Two foreign movies. I can never remember her last name. Vera, she's Czech. She did Daisies.
Ooh, you're on your own there.
And it's kind of... It's about misbehaving. It's a pair about misbehaving in very existential ways.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are scratching their head. We were supposed to do An American Werewolf in London and Clown next week. But basically what happened is Clown's not out in the United States. And we knew this, and we've been waiting to put it on the show, and there was no sign it was coming out. So we basically said, fuck it, we'll do it this year. We set a date for it, and then I went to hang out on this commercial shoot in LA, and whoops, turns out it's for Clown, some kind of Clown promo that I probably shouldn't talk about, and it does have a release date, and the release date is this year. So it makes more sense if everyone can see it. We're just going to move that on down the line. So we'll do Daisies and Bad Education now.
It's a fucked up pair next week.
Awesome. I'm excited.
One of them's NC-17, so get your boners out and watch more fucking film.
Ugh. All right, bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.